Worldwide, cardiovascular disease affects the lives of hundreds of millions. Dedicated cardio nerds everywhere are working hard to fight this global epidemic. These are their stories.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another fantastic episode in our Cardio Nerds Prevention Series. My name is Gerline Kaur, and I am a resident at Brigham and Women's Hospital, as well as House Eindhoven Chief and Director of the Cardio Nerds Internship. Today, we're so excited to discuss the role of obesity in cardiovascular disease, as well as the procedural and medical management of obesity to improve cardiovascular disease. I'm joined by fellow cardio nerd and Johns Hopkins Medicine Cardiology Fellow Rick Ferraro. Rick, so excited to discuss this topic with you today.
Gerline, I agree. I'm so excited. It's going to be a fantastic discussion, rounding out our series on obesity here, and can't wait to get started. I'm also honored to introduce Rupan Bose. He is a Cardio Nerds family member, but this is his first recording with us for an episode here. He's a cardiology fellow at UCLA Harbor Medical Center in Los Angeles and Cardio Nerds Fit Trialist for the Zeus Trial. Rupan, welcome to Cardio Nerds. And could you mind sharing a little bit of what it means to be a Fit Trialist and kind of what is your role then?
Thank you, Rick, and thank you to the rest of the Cardio Nerds family for welcoming me to the family. As Rick mentioned, my name is Rupan Bose, and I'm very excited to be here. Speaking of the Cardio Nerds Fit, so working with the Cardio Nerds Fit Clinical Trial Network has been an incredible experience. I've had the opportunity to work one-on-one with my mentor and PI, Dr. Matthew Budoff. He's given me an opportunity to gain hands-on experience on how to design and implement an effective clinical trial. I've also been able to work directly with our research team to recruit participants. Additionally, thanks to the large Cardio Nerds network, we've had the opportunity to learn from several national leaders and trial experts through a series of talks and lectures. Overall, this experience has really helped me shape my own clinical research interests, and I encourage all Cardio Nerds family members to think about joining the Cardio Nerds Clinical Trial Network.
Wow, Rupan, that really sounds like a great and educational learning experience. And speaking of clinical trialists and amazing mentors, I am beyond honored to welcome a great cardiovascular leader and expert of our time, Dr. Steve Nissen. Dr. Nissen is the Chief Academic Officer of the Siddle and Arnold Miller Family Heart Vascular and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. He also holds the Lewis and Patricia Dickey Chair in Cardiovascular Medicine. In his over 35 years as a physician and researcher, Dr. Nissen has written more than 400 journal articles and 60 book chapters. He is a leading voice on drug safety and has testified as an expert in front of both the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. Dr. Nissen also previously served as a president of the American College of Cardiology, as well as the ACC Board of Trustees. He is the editor of Current Cardiology Report. He's even been listed in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World. And when he isn't saving the world from cardiovascular disease, Dr. Nissen loves biking and is an avid photographer. Dr. Nissen, we are so excited to have you here on the podcast and learn from your expertise. Welcome back to Cardio Nerds.
Thank you. That was a very kind introduction, and I'm very impressed by Cardio Nerds. You all are just a fantastic team of people that are doing important educational work, which is why I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nissen. It's a really privilege for us to have you. So today we want to discuss a topic with global implications. We're thankfully turning the corner from the COVID pandemic. But the World Health Organization has highlighted another rising epidemic, and this is the obesity. According to the American Heart Association, approximately 2.8 to 3.5 billion people worldwide are either overweight or have obesity. Dr. Nissen, what do you see as the drivers of this, both nationally and globally? And to set the stage for our discussion, what do you see as the role of obesity as a comorbidity in cardiovascular risk overall?
It's a very important topic, and it is important to understand that obesity over the decades has just gotten to be worse and worse. No one can tell you exactly why, but certainly in many countries where food was less plentiful in a previous era, millennia, the fat was adapted. And what's happened now is with more plentiful availability of food, that gene or set of genes that lead to people to overeat has become pathological. That's the best I can do about telling you why. What you said about the incidence is extraordinary. In the U.S., by 2030, it's predicted that 30% of the people will have a BMI of more than 30. And not far behind is Mexico and the UK, and even countries like China and Japan and Italy, where obesity was virtually unknown, are now seeing a rise in cases.
Thank you very much for that astute, excellent commentary, Dr. Nissen. I want to now transfer us over to our Cardio Nerds Prevention Clinic, where we would love to discuss some specific cases with you. Here in room number one is our very first patient, Miss Y. Miss Y is a 22-year-old female with a history of prediabetes and white coat hypertension. During her intake, her BMI is measured to be 28. She is here today because she is concerned that everyone in her family is obese and has diabetes. She is particularly concerned because she has been unintentionally gaining weight recently. She wants to know what impact her weight and BMI may have on her health in the future. Dr. Nissen, what advice do you have for this young, proactive patient? And in particular, how do you determine her goal weight and BMI? I'd also love to ask you, what are your thoughts on BMI as a measure for obesity?
Okay, there's a lot packed into this case. First of all, we do know a lot about childhood obesity. It turns out that now she's not a child, but my guess is that she was gaining weight in her teenage years. Below the age of 21, we would say that's youthful obesity. And what we know is that if you're obese as a child or a young adult, it portends great difficulty later on. And what's so interesting is if you can return to a normal body weight at that point in your life, you largely prevent the downstream consequences of obesity. My prediction would be, based upon her family history, that she will continue to gain weight over time. And what she's going to have to do is, it's really about calories in and calories out. And almost everybody whose weight is going up, they're just consuming more calories than they burn. You have a couple of things you can do. You can either consume fewer calories or you could burn more calories. And both strategies are probably important. And let me tell you why. If she attempts to lose weight, she'll be successful typically for a few weeks or months. And then what happens is there's an adaptive response, where there is downregulation of metabolism so that she actually burns fewer calories. And so it gets harder and harder to sustain weight loss and to continue weight loss. And the way you counteract that is by increasing activity level. It shouldn't have to be a marathon runner. If she can just get out and every day after work or after school and walk as fast and as far as she can, I can tell you that I personally get 15,000 plus steps a day, and it keeps me thin. And she's got to be counseled to do the same.
Thank you, Dr. Nissen, for walking us through how you would approach the case of Miss Y in our Cardio Nurse Prevention Clinic, and that really important point of the adaptive response and how it's important to both decrease calories and also increase physical activity. Now, as we talked about a little bit, as childhood obesity is rising, at what age should we start screening for obesity and addressing it in our clinics?
I think screening should occur in childhood. Clearly, if you want to see how bad the situation is, go to a fast food restaurant and just watch who's standing in line buying the supersized soda and burger. It's teenagers. And look at their waist circumference. And I want to get back to this issue of BMI versus waist circumference. But you'll see that they're already on the pathway toward obesity. I know what they're going to look like at age 35 or 40, and it's pretty hard to reverse the disorder if you allow people to get to those BMIs of 30, 35, and 40. Now, you raised this question earlier about, is BMI the best measure? And it's not. Waist circumference is a very important measure. In fact, if you look at patients with a given BMI, let's say 28 kilograms per meter squared, which is considered overweight but not obese, if you look at the interquartile range for BMI, it varies from about 88 centimeters to 104 centimeters. And if you look at the 95% confidence limits, it goes from about 85 to about 105 centimeters. Those are very different patterns. And we know that it is the abdominal obesity that is so toxic. Fat cells are not inert. They make cytokines. Those cytokines are then traveled to the liver, where they result in production of inflammatory substances, IL-1 beta, IL-6, and CRP. And so, among other things, they lead to this inflammatory state. What's so interesting is I'm doing some very big trials in obesity, and what you see is the people entering the trial have C-reactive protein levels that are high. They're high because of the effect of that cytokine production. So we have to be cognizant of the fact that it is in intra-abdominal fat. Now, everybody's heard this, and I'll just say it again. If you are apple-shaped, meaning you have a bulging tummy, you're at higher cardiovascular risk than if you have a pear-shaped. And the two patterns of obesity are different typically in men and women. Men are more likely to have intra-abdominal obesity, although women can too. And women are more likely to have that pear shape where their obesity is in their buttocks and thighs, and they're shaped more like a pear. And they seem to have lower inflammatory markers and less cardiovascular disease.
Thank you for those perspectives for Ms. Y. I'd love to keep this going and learn more about our next patient, Mr. G. Mr. G is a 45-year-old male with a history of hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, and a BMI of 42. Mr. G used to be an active gentleman and proudly remembers his championship college football days when he was a star defensive lineman. Unfortunately, after a season-ending injury, he says his life changed for the worse. He gained weight, and now he can only perform limited exercise without dyspnea, as well as bilateral knee and lower back pain. Mr. G is here today because one of his ex-teammates told him to see if surgery might help him lose the weight and keep it off, and he wants to learn more. Dr. Nissen, what procedures or surgeries are available to patients with obesity?
This is a very important case and one we have to talk about, because while bariatric surgery cannot be used for the billions of people that are obese, it can be used for some. Now, I want to talk a little bit about this guy's history. Football players, somebody has actually looked carefully at people that are in training, playing high-level football, college level and pro level. And the number of calories they consume a day is almost beyond measure. It's 6,000, 7,000 calories a day. And they need that because of the extreme exercise that they're doing, the weightlifting and they're running and they're tackling and so on. Then when they stop doing the sports, they keep eating the way they did when they were a football player. And guess what? They end up like this gentleman with a BMI of 45. Now, my colleague, Alian Aminian, and I have studied bariatric surgery and obesity. And before that, we did some work together with Phil Schauer, who formerly headed the bariatric surgery program at the Cleveland Clinic. And the first study we did was the STAMPEDE trial. It was a small trial. It's the only trial I've ever published three times in the New England Journal of Medicine. We published the 1 year and the 3 year and the 5 year results. But what happened was we took people with diabetes and obesity and we randomized into groups of 50 patients each to usual care where they were really cared for by a very good endocrinologist or a Roux-en-Y bypass operation or a gastric sleeve procedure where the stomach is made smaller. And what happened is the bariatric surgical patients, most of them had complete remission of their diabetes. The result was shocking because essentially, if you get people before they're really at the end stage of diabetes, you can absolutely reverse it if you do bariatric surgery and they lose, of course, a great deal of weight. Subsequently, Dr. Minnie and I did a very carefully controlled observational study where we matched up obese patients that had come in for bariatric surgery, but mostly had been declined by insurance to have it. And we matched them carefully with many characteristics with a group of people that underwent bariatric surgery. We published this work in 2019 in JAMA, And what we showed is that those people in who had bariatric surgery compared with their matched cohort had a huge reduction in myocardial infarction, stroke, kidney disease, and death. The results were just stunning, with hazard ratios that were extraordinarily low. And that is a widely cited evidence that if we could find ways to get people to lose weight, we can prevent the cardiovascular consequences of obesity. So this patient is a pretty good patient to consider bariatric surgery. Now, if you had asked me 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I would have said, he needs bariatric surgery. Today, I think it's not unreasonable to give a trial of either a GLP-1 agonist or a dual GLP-1 agonist, GIP agonist. Those drugs, particularly the dual agonist drug, can reduce body weight by 20% or more. And in some people, they get an extraordinary reduction in body weight. I'd probably try that first, but I would have very little hesitation to, before this guy gets into really big trouble, to recommend bariatric surgery. One more point. His joint problems have two origins: his football days and his obesity. Obese patients end up with joint replacements. They have horrible orthopedic complications. It's not just cardiovascular disease. It's also those other diseases that they suffer from.
Yeah, Dr. Nissen, that was such a good series of points that you made. And you actually took the words out of my mouth, because I was going to say, in the age of Ozempic and GLP-1s, how has our consideration for bariatric surgery and some of these procedural management for obesity options, how has that changed? And you know, I want to follow up on that a little bit more in terms of candidates for these procedures. You had mentioned sometimes maybe giving them a trial of meds now because, you know, they've been so extraordinary. But who do you think are now in kind of 2023, 2024, the best candidates for these procedures?
First of all, I think it's a difficult call. But first of all, let's take semaglutide, which you mentioned, which is the appropriate generic name for the drug you mentioned. Semaglutide, when given in high doses, in the SELECT trial, they only got a 9.3% reduction in body weight. Now, they had a wonderful cardiovascular result, but if you take somebody with a BMI of 42, they're not going to lose 9 or 10% of body weight. You can imagine somebody who's 280 pounds and they lose 28 pounds. They're still over 250 pounds. And so the magnitude of weight loss is not as great. So the really severely obese, there is obviously an advantage of bariatric surgery, particularly Roux-en-Y bypass. Now, tirzepatide, which is the dual agonist, now approved for both obesity and diabetes, in the SURMOUNT-1 trial, achieved about a 22% body weight reduction. Now you're getting into the ballpark where you may want to be able to give that a try. And by the way, it's actually better tolerated than semaglutide. So the dual GIP-GLP-1 agonist is a really great choice here, and it can be considered. If I saw this patient, I would probably offer the patient both options, but I would also tell the patient that drugs alone would not likely get him down to his ideal weight, which is going to be, and a BMI of 42 is going to be a huge amount of weight loss. Maybe 40% weight loss would be required.
That's a great point. Thank you for correcting me there.
Thank you for walking us through that. One follow-up question. For those who do undergo these procedures or start these medications, there are the outcomes we get in the short term, but how successful are they at keeping the weight off in the long term? And what factors or what variables or what determinants really drive that ability for the long term?
So we now have 10-year follow-up on a lot of the patients we've been studying with bariatric surgery, and they regain only a little bit of their body weight. It is quite a durable procedure, and so are the drugs. Now, I'm going to tell you, I get pushback from some people about something, and I want to take it on directly. They say, wait a minute, if you give these drugs like semaglutide or tirzepatide, and people lose weight. And then they come off the drugs, they regain all the weight. And that's true. But I'm going to ask a rhetorical question. You folks are, I'm sure, very good clinicians. If somebody comes into your office with hypertension, they put them on an antihypertensive drug and their blood pressure goes down, do you then take the drug away? No, you don't. If they come in with a high LDL and you put them on a statin and their LDL goes down, do you take the drug away? No. If you put them on a drug for obesity, they have to stay on the drug if they want to keep the weight off. That it's a disease. It's a lifelong disease. And it doesn't spontaneously remit. What we do know is that in some pretty long-term studies of these incretin drugs, which is the class that they're in, the weight loss is generally pretty well maintained out for 5, 7, 8, even longer years. I'm very optimistic that can be done. Now, they're the cost of the drugs, of course, but that's not going to be true forever. They're going to be generic versions eventually. And I think that's why we're at a turning point in the treatment of the disease. I wanted to make one more point that I think is really important. And it's a point about ethnicity. So I certainly see a lot of South Asian patients, and they are very insulin resistant. They are not classified as obese based on body mass index. Their BMI may be 25 and a half or 26. But if you look at them, they have that kind of tummy bulge, a little tummy bulge. So they have that apple shape, but it's not readily apparent unless you look for it. Let me tell you what we know is that the cardiovascular and diabetes consequences of obesity, that a South Asian with a BMI of 22.6 has the same risk of a white European at a BMI of 30. It's quite a striking finding. And so a normal BMI and a normal waist circumference are different based on an ethnicity, and we have to be cognizant.
Thank you so much for rounding with us, Dr. Nissen, and really walking us through also the specific risk factors and unique aspects of taking care of South Asian patients. You've really opened our eyes to the many options available in treating patients with obesity, both in terms of medications and the procedural options. Now, I wanted to ask your advice on a related matter. So one of the challenges we know when seeing patients regarding addressing obesity and potential procedures is that weight and body image can be a very sensitive subject for patients, and it carries a stigma. In your experience, how can we as clinicians and caregivers create a safe and welcome space to discuss this topic with our patients? And aside from clinicians and patients, who are the other team members, other partners, and stakeholders that we can recruit to help our patients achieve the greatest chance of success?
That is a wonderful question, and it's an important one. We absolutely have to be sensitive. And I'm going to tell you, I have a colleague. When I was chair of cardiovascular medicine, we get these ombudsman reports. And I got an ombudsman report one day that this cardiologist walked into a room with a patient and told her that she was fat. And she complained. And the patient was right. You never say anything like that to a patient. They know that they're obese. You don't have to say it to them. I think what we have to do is understand their circumstances. Some people eat because of stress. And if you don't ask about whether they're under that kind of stress, you don't get the right answer. Now, in our clinic, embedded in our prevention clinic, we have dietitians, really good dietitians, do dietary counseling. We have a psychiatrist that sees our patients in the prevention clinic. He's just a wonderful guy. Let me tell you that people that are obese are often depressed. And I would just mention for a moment that there is an antidepressant, which is actually a pretty good choice for patients that are obese. And that's bupropion, which actually will facilitate a little bit of weight loss. It's actually a really good choice for obese individuals. But I do think we have to be sensitive. We have to listen to the patients, understand what's driving their problem, get them dietary counseling. That's part of the team. If they need psychiatric help, get them a psychiatric help. Because if we don't treat all of those aspects, the psychosocial aspects of the disorder, we will not be successful. And there is one more thing. Obesity is a disease that has a greater prevalence amongst people that are economically disadvantaged. And most people think the reason why is that fast food, unhealthy food, is cheaper than healthy food. And when I came to the Cleveland Clinic, I stayed in a motel across from the Cleveland Clinic. And the only market that I could walk over to while I was waiting for my house to be ready to move into was in a neighborhood, which is one that's, Cleveland's got a lot of areas that are pretty down and dilapidated. And I went into this market and I looked around at the food choices and I was horrified. There was almost nothing healthy. And so I think we also have to understand the economics of this, which is that people that are poor are more likely to be eating the wrong foods. And that's going to be fueling their obesity.
Thank you for walking us through those really important points of how to address obesity in the clinic and also the impact of socioeconomic factors. We really need to understand the barriers that the patients that we're seeing, what the barriers are that they're facing in terms of both diet and access to physical activity. Now, shifting back a little bit to our discussion from earlier, we had touched upon the topic of GLP-1 agonists and the remarkable cardiovascular benefits of these medications. And now we've been having even more data, like the recent SELECT trial published and presented at AHA. How do medications and procedures affect the long-term cardiac outcomes in these patients?
I do think that the SELECT trial is an extraordinary study. It was done well. Some mistakes were made in trial design, and everybody who's knowledgeable knows that. There was a 20% reduction in the triple endpoint of cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI, or stroke. They had a hierarchical testing procedure, and what happened was the next in the hierarchy was cardiovascular death, and they missed on cardiovascular death. The p-value was 0.07, and so they really couldn't test for non-fatal MI or non-fatal stroke. Having said that, I think all three endpoints are almost certainly affected. And remember that this occurred with a weight loss that was only 9%. And that's amazing because let me tell you what's coming. You know about tirzepatide. It's now approved for weight loss. I am chairing a 15,000 patient trial. My co-chair is Dr. Carolyn Lam in Singapore, wonderful cardiologist. And we know that this drug in a 72-week trial produced a 22.5% median weight loss. We also know that there is another drug coming along very quickly called retatrutide. It's a triple agonist. It's GLP-1, GIP, and glucagon. And it produced a 24% weight loss. That tells us that we are approaching efficacy similar to bariatric surgery. Typically, a Roux-en-Y bypass, you're getting about 25% on average weight loss. With retatrutide, as this goes forward, assuming that everything works out, it'll be on the market in a couple of years. We're talking about a drug that can achieve similar weight loss. And by the way, that was achieved in 48 weeks, 1 year. And the weight was still going down at the end of 1 year with the optimal dose of the drug. In female patients, this triple agonist, the median weight loss was 28.5%. It was a big trial, very successful. One more thing, there is an oral GLP-1. Now, it's now been developed called orforglipron. And it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine this year. Mean BMI at the start was 38. And they lost 15% of weight loss in just 36 weeks with an oral GLP-1 agonist for those people that don't want to self-inject with these once-a-week injectable drugs. So we are really on the verge of a revolution here. And I am very optimistic that we'll be able to do with drugs what we do with bariatric surgery. We can't do it quite yet, but we're getting there.
Yeah, Dr. Nissen, that's incredibly exciting. And wow, hearing about some of these upcoming trials, I can't wait to see the results. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this in the future. But I wanted to ask you a bit of a follow-up question. As someone who's interested in preventative cardiology, this is really an interesting moment because I'm not sure that I'm familiar with a medication taking off like this before. I let slip a trade name before, but it's almost a pop culture phenomenon what's been happening with these medications. Are there any lessons you think we have here for how we can increase comfort levels or even enthusiasm for alternative medications, say statins or procedures, like you said, like bariatric surgery when patients remain good candidates?
First of all, it is terribly important that cardiologists be engaged in this. An awful lot of cardiologists will say, I'm sending you over to my endocrinology friends for management of your obesity. This is our disease. Obesity kills by cardiovascular death. And we were able to show that we could reduce cardiovascular death with bariatric surgery. And we're going to be able to show it with drugs very soon with these better drugs. It's an injectable. It's been used extensively for diabetes. And most cardiologists are unwilling to prescribe the drugs. I prescribe them. I'm perfectly comfortable prescribing them. And our colleagues, and particularly our young cardiologists, need to get comfortable with prescribing these formerly diabetes drugs, but now weight loss drugs. They're very safe. They're easy to use. You can almost just read the product literature and know enough to actually know how to use them. And I want everybody to get engaged with doing it because I fought the statin wars. When we started out with statins, a tiny fraction of the patients with very high LDLs were being treated. And we went on the stump and we did grand rounds and we did all kinds of educational programs. And we fought our way through it to the point now where most secondary prevention patients and about half primary prevention patients who should be on statins are actually on statins. Only a very tiny fraction of obese patients are getting optimal care. And the only way we're going to get there is if we have people like us get involved because we are the doctors taking care of these patients for their cardiovascular morbidity.
Yeah, that's such a crucial point. Provider comfort with these medications still really isn't there, and it's something we need to work on. We're fortunate. We do also have a GLP-1 specific series here that we're doing, so excited to point our listeners towards that. But Dr. Nissen, I'd love to hear, as we wrap up our conversation here, kind of any main takeaways or insights that you'd like to give us to our audience in addition to all the great comments you've had already.
I do think that there are some other downstream consequences that I want everybody to be aware of, and that's non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It turns out now that if you go back to 2013, 2014, the leading cause of liver transplantation in the United States was hepatitis C, which is now being eradicated. It is now NASH cirrhosis. And what happens with obesity is you get fatty liver. It's often not recognized because providers are not sensitive to the fact that if you see elevated liver enzymes, there may be a problem, and you get a liver ultrasound, you see these globules of fat. And it's another reason for very aggressive treatment of those patients because they will go on from NAFL, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, to non-alcoholic steatohepatitis or NASH, to cirrhosis, to liver transplantation or liver death. Now, Dr. Aminian and I studied it, and what we showed was an unbelievable hazard ratio for reduction in end-stage liver disease. I'm talking about needing a transplant or liver death. The hazard ratio after bariatric surgery compared with matched controls was 0.12. It is essentially an eightfold decrease in the risk of going on to, I'm talking about end-stage major adverse liver outcomes. So I want everybody who takes care of these patients to be aware that we got to look for NASH. We've got to intervene early and particularly get weight loss of those patients. And if we do, there's a very good chance we can prevent them from having liver death.
Wow. Thank you so much for that guidance. And thank you for all that. We've had such a wonderful time with you today, Dr. Nissen. One last question from our end. Dr. Nissen, what makes your heart flutter about cardiovascular prevention?
Oh, my goodness. I started out and I was a cath guy, and I realized that we were patching up the problem. And eventually, I got very interested in the potential to prevent the disease. And I did a trial about 20 plus years ago called Reversal, where we showed that using intravascular ultrasound that we could actually stop the progression of coronary disease. And that led to a whole series of other interventions designed to prevent the disease. But there's an old Chinese proverb about really good doctors don't treat disease, they prevent disease. And I'm more excited than ever. There are other targets we haven't even talked about, and I'm very excited. Well, maybe someday we can talk about lipoprotein A, where we're doing a whole series of trials. So I think we will be able to help many more people by preventing disease. Yes, we could stent coronary stenoses, but I'd rather never even get to a coronary stenosis. And that's what excites me about prevention.
Dr. Nissen, it's so great to hear about your path in prevention and just the passion that you have for changing the course of disease for a patient. Thank you so much for teaching us all about the impact of obesity on cardiovascular disease and the nuances of both medical and procedural management. So this episode concludes our three-part CardioNerd series focused on obesity. And it's just such an exciting time for obesity medicine and addressing cardiometabolic risk in our patients with all of these new trials, and definitely a lot to look forward to with some of the upcoming medications that you mentioned. It's truly just been an honor to learn from your expertise, and there's just been so many pearls and take-home points from this discussion. And I also want to thank Roopan and Rick for crafting such an excellent discussion tonight.
And thank you all for inviting me. I think CardioNerds is doing a fantastic job, and I enjoy working with you.
Such a fantastic discussion. Thank you, Dr. Nissen.
Thank you for tuning in to this CardioNerd episode. The audio and editing for this episode was performed by me, Atefe Ghorbanzadeh. I'm an intern in CardioNerd Academy House in Tolmet and a research fellow at the Mayo Clinic. I invite you to check out our website for show notes and references. If you find this episode informative, please consider subscribing to CardioNerd on your favorite podcast platform and leaving us a review. It really helps us spread the word for our goal to democratize cardiovascular education. Finally, this podcast is not meant to be used for medical advice. The views and expressions on our show and site do not reflect the opinion or policy of our employers. All CardioNerd content is planned, produced, and reviewed solely by CardioNerd. Stay tuned for more engaging conversation and exploration on our upcoming episodes.
And team, one last thing. This episode is produced in collaboration with the American Society of Preventive Cardiology with independent medical education grant support from Novo Nordisk.
And now it's time to make like S2 and a split.